I've never felt like this before. It's like you just get me. I feel like my true self with you. Does that sound crazy? And it doesn't hurt that you're gorgeous. Okay, that's it. I'm taking you home with me. I mean, you can't find shoes this good just anywhere. Find a shoe for every you from brands you love, like Birkenstock, Nike, Adidas, and more at your DSW store or DSW.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Some people follow the rules, but where's the fun in that? I'm Soraya, and this is Rule Breakers, the podcast where we celebrate the rebels, the risk takers, and the ones who make their own way. Every week, I sit down with the boldest voices in sports, entertainment, and beyond to talk about breaking barriers, defying expectations, and rewriting the rules. No limits, no apologies, just real talk. Follow and listen to Rule Breakers with Soraya, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, 70 degrees right now, 50% chance for showers, and you heard Peyton Malone say it's hard to predict when those showers are going to pop up. They had some street flooding in the Ninth Ward in Gretna yesterday, and it all depends on, you know, we're below sea level. I don't think I have to tell you that, but it all depends on how quickly and how much it rains and whether or not there's going to be some street flooding. So Peyton said they can't really tell you where or when or what's going to park over where. So I guess just be aware of it today. Highs of 82, 40% chance for showers tomorrow. Highs 83. Then the good news heading into the first weekend of Jazz Fest, Thursday, sunny, highs of 84. Likewise, Friday, 85 and 86. Saturday and Sunday, dry, no chance for showers, which is good because we also have the Zurich Classic underway. Christopher Bellito joins us now, professor of history and a papal historian at Kane University, to talk about the conclave and the selection of the new pope after the passing of Pope Francis. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, sir. Professor, I got to ask, I know this is steeped in ritual and tradition, but does there exist somewhere some type of, I hate to call it a policy and procedure manual, to make sure that everything is done according to the rules that I guess we'll get to that in a second. What is the cardinal that's in charge of this called that would go to see that everything's being done according to procedure?
Yeah, well, let me start at the top. Yes, there is a book. It's largely written by John Paul II in 1996 with a couple of little changes and tweaks. But locking people up into a conclave, literally conclave, cum clavis from Latin, with a key, dates back to the year 1274, when a particular church council put this into law. For the first about 1,200 years of the church, the Bishop of Rome or the Pope was chosen by either people in Rome calling out names and agreeing, what's called acclamation, or the warring families in Rome picking someone. So this process is about 750 years old, and it is in fact written down, and the key person to whom you referred is the Camerlengo, something like a chief of staff. Mm-hmm. And if you saw the movie Conclave, this was Cardinal Lawrence, who was played by the actor Ralph Fiennes. This fellow now is a cardinal by the name of Kevin Farrell, born in Ireland, who has spent his career among Spanish-speaking communities and then came to the United States, I think about in his 30s, and spent his career in the Archdiocese of Washington and then was the Bishop of Dallas until he was called to Rome.
What does he do when the Pope is alive and functioning?
Nothing. This is his job. He has other jobs. Cardinal Farrell right. has other jobs within the Curia. But when a papal death is kind of like a starting pistol. And so there's no surprise as to how this plays out. So the funeral has to be within 4 to 6 days. In this case, it's been announced on day six for Saturday. Then there's 9 official days of mourning, and the conclave has to begin 15 to 20 days after the Pope's death. It can begin a day or two earlier than day 15 if everything is set, but there's an awful lot to do. So I don't expect they'll announce this soon enough. Probably around May 4th or 5th, the conclave will begin. It'll probably take one, two, or 3 days. Probably by about May 8th or 9th, we'll have a new pope.
When it comes to the funeral services for, well, let me take a step back, Professor. You mentioned that this procedure was changed by Pope. Did you say John Paul II or John 23rd?
Well, the Pope Gregory X in 1274 put this into play, but in 1996, Pope John Paul II did a major update, and the major update was when you only had two or three dozen cardinals, they could sleep in the rooms outside of the Sistine Chapel. If you've been to the Vatican, right, the Vatican Museum, there are all these little rooms. But now you've got 110, 20, 30 cardinal electors, many of them elderly. And so what John Paul II did in the 1990s was he built a dormitory, which is where Pope Francis lived, the dormitory or the House of St. Martha. And so the cardinals will essentially be a sequestered jury. That was kind of the major change that John Paul II made in 1996.
So when you see a movie like, I think it was The Shoes of the Fisherman, and they're constructing these little apartments, that's the old way. The new way is now they go to like a hotel or a dormitory or something?
Yeah. The movie Conclave, you know, apart from kind of the politics of it, was very accurate in terms of the procedures.
Okay. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back and talk about what happens. I want to do real quick before we take a break. This Pope changed his funeral arrangements, right? And talk about the differences with Pope Francis and some of the ceremony as it relates to the funerals of other popes.
Well, the funerals of popes from John Paul II to Benedict XVI and now to Francis have been progressively simpler. And so this is just a natural progression. You know, the Pope is a monarch. The papacy is the longest monarchy that's still going in the history of the world. Before that, of course, you had the Egyptian pharaohs for thousands of years. And so the burial of a monarch was very elaborate. But starting with Paul VI, who was buried in a simple wooden coffin with an open book of the Gospels on it, things have really dialed down.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Professor Christopher Bellido, a professor of history and a papal historian at Kane University. It is interesting about the way a new pope is selected. We'll get more into it when we return. 620 Traffic Now, WWL. 625 Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to Professor Christopher Bellido, a professor of history and a papal historian at Kane University. Professor, what did the movie Conclave get right and what did it get wrong?
Well, it got right a lot of the procedures. For instance, when the cardinals go into a vote, it's nothing like an American political convention. There are no nominating speeches or acceptance speeches. All they do is vote. They vote twice in the morning and twice in the afternoon. So a morning session, they count the votes, exactly what occurred in the film. Each one writes down a name and a pre-printed card that says in Latin, Eligo in summum pontificem, I elect a supreme pontiff. They walk down the aisle. They make a declaration in Latin. I say that this is the person that I think should be chosen pope. And they put the ballot in kind of a big urn. The votes are count. The ballots are counted. So if there are 135 electors, but there are 136 ballots, they're not open. They're not counted. They're burned. That wasn't in the film. If there are 135, then they begin the vote. The first cardinal, there are three of them, chosen by lot, reads the name, writes it down. The second does the same. The third is the person who reads the name out and then kind of cancels the ballot to say that it's been counted by putting a needle and thread in it, which is gloriously old-fashioned. You need two-thirds vote If nobody gets the two-thirds in the morning in the first vote, they proceed immediately to the second. If nobody gets it there, they take a break for lunch. They come back late in the afternoon, and they do it all over again until they have two-thirds or two-thirds plus one. If there's no valid, successful election, they burn the ballots with some pellets that produce black smoke, no election, letting people outside know. White smoke, Bianca, Bianca, the crowd will shout. Means that there is in fact a successful vote. So those procedures were done correctly. Some mistakes that are made is there is no way that Cardinal Lawrence would have heard someone's confession and then revealed, as he does with the African nun, and then revealed the contents of that confession to another person, as he does to a cardinal. A cardinal who shows up with a note from the prior pope and says, the prior pope made me cardinal in secret, that person would not be able to enter into the conclave because the prior pope would have to make that public.
Let me jump in real quick, Professor, and move from the movie to the real, and that is yesterday we had a guest that told us Pope Francis appointed about 80% of the cardinals that are going to be voting in this pontifical, I guess it's an election, is that what you call it, selection process? So have previous popes, first of all, does that mean that the deck is stacked toward predecessor? Okay, go ahead.
I don't know who you had yesterday, and with all due respect, that position is nonsense. Cardinals, school principals, CEOs, everyone surrounds themselves with people who are like-minded. John Paul II did the exact same thing, and Benedict did the exact same thing. Some of the people who criticized Francis for doing that seems to think that that was just fine under John Paul II and Benedict XVI. Mm. And I just published a piece this morning that says you have to expect the unexpected. If the Italians had been stacking the deck for 455 years, how do you get a Polish pope in 1978? Mm-hmm. If Benedict and John Paul II, who were of a more conservative bent, had stacked the deck, how do you get Bergoglio, a very different person, in 2013? So that's it's simply a nonsensical charge.
Do you have any names that
no.
You're looking at? No? Do you think anybody has any idea at this point?
Well, you know, there's an old saying, the people who know aren't talking and the people who are talking don't know. I think this is a wide open election. It's kind of a bit of a wild card election. If you look at the history of papal elections, people talk about the papabile, which in Italian is a great word, literally means popable. You know, kind of the inside 10 or 20 people. And I could come up with a list of 20 and someone else could come up with a list of 20 and there could be no overlap of either of them. It probably seems likely, you know, Francis was in the mold more of a pastor than of an administrator. Probably they may go in that direction. Probably for the first time in history, half of the College of Cardinals who are voting will be from outside of Europe and North America. That's still disproportionate, but the church is faltering north of the equator and flourishing south of the equator. So could be that we're going to get someone from Africa or Asia or maybe Latin America again. But the answer is expect the unexpected.
Thank you, Professor. Appreciate your time. Hope we get to talk to you again. Christopher Bellito, Professor of History and a Papal Historian at Kane University. We'll take a break, talk about Neptune Pass when we return. Right now, time for WWL First News. 6:46, 14 till 7 now on this Tuesday morning. Kind of misty and foggy outside, I guess, after all the rain and the dampness that's in the ground. Another chance for showers today. Had some flooding yesterday in areas of the 9th Ward. Also, Gretna, it all depends, as y'all well know, when the rain falls and how quickly it falls and how much. And they don't know right now where exactly that's going to happen, but there is a chance for showers, so be aware of that. 50% chance for rain, and who knows where they could pop up. That's what the weather people are saying. Highs of 83 today. Pretty much same thing for tomorrow, but then for Jazz Fest, Zurich Classic, it clears out, sunny and warm, highs between 85 and maybe 86 all the way through the weekend, plenty of sunshine. Alex Coker joins us now, Associate Professor of Coastal Geology at Louisiana University's Marine Consortium. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. It's great to be here.
Let's talk about Neptune Pass, I guess specifically as we discuss sediment diversions, because we spent a lot of time here talking about the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion, and it seems as though Neptune Pass could be a preview, if you will, a rehearsal for the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion or not.
Well, Neptune Pass, you know, it's this cut about 50 in the river, about 50 miles downstream of New Orleans, and it moves, it functions a little bit like a sediment diversion. In fact, it functions a little bit like the way that the Mississippi River Delta was built.
It let me take a break first, Alex. Let me go back and talk about Neptune Pass and the origins, because while we talk about it all the time, maybe people are tuning in and they don't understand what it is. So I guess that's my fault. We should back up and talk about how Neptune Pass came to be.
Yeah, Neptune Pass is a channel. It was starting before 2020. It was just a small little canal that connected the Mississippi River to Breton Sound, to Quarantine Bay, which is one of the bays in southeast Louisiana. It's about 50 miles downstream of New Orleans, near the town of Empire, but on the other side. And then somewhere around 2020, that system expanded by like a factor of 10 in less than a year. And so it now carries 15% of the Mississippi River. And so it's bringing water from the Mississippi River to Quarantine Bay. And it is building a delta. It's building a landscape of islands and shallow water sandbars that is it's one of the largest new deltas in North America.
So compare and contrast what this was able to accomplish as opposed to a dredging project if the same thing had been attempted in the same area over the same time period, if that's a fair question.
It is a good question. I'll be straight up and saying I haven't done that particular math, but we got a system that is, say, 3,000 acres of shallow water environments. Some of these things are exposed when the water levels are low. Some of these things are covered with little bit of water when the water level is up. And we've got about 3,000 acres of shallow water habitat out there, which is actually faster than you might expect from a lot of dredging projects. Some of that material was scoured from the channel, just extracted from the channel when it eroded, but actually a fair amount of it was created by sediment coming down the Mississippi River, building land kind of in the way that people envision in the diversions. So, and actually we think that the amount of, and so, so it built 3,000 acres of shallow water environment pretty quickly.
What has it done to seafood in the area or wildlife in the area?
Yeah, if you go out there, there's plenty of birds in the area, particularly when those shallow water areas are low, those areas are filled with birds. It probably hasn't changed the salinity all that much because the area was already fresh. So we're not seeing any major changes in salinity because the area was already pretty dominated by fresh water. There's actually a few other cuts that carry a significant amount of fresh water, just a little bit upstream and a little bit downstream of it.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. Talking to Alex Coker, Associate Professor of Coastal Geology at Louisiana University's Marine Consortium. If you listen regularly, you know we've spent a lot of time talking about the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion, about Neptune Pass, about Mardi Gras Pass, about different things that are going on in terms of building sediment. You mentioned when the water's high, Alex, I'm going to talk about building land above the ground, because I hear that phrase used and I don't understand with tides how you can always say it's above the ground or below, or how do you keep score when it comes to that, right? So we'll pick it up there. We come back. Time for traffic now on WWL. 657, 3 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Alex Coker, Associate Professor of Coastal Geology at Louisiana University Marine Consortium. A new study about Neptune Pass. The pass now has a flow five times that of New York's Hudson River. Professor, when you talk about land being built up, and I see pictures that this in the story I'm looking at of people standing on the land, but they're in like ankle-deep or shin-deep water, I get confused sometimes when it comes to keeping score or deciding what's land build up and what's not, because they talk about it being above the water level, but that all depends on the tides, right? What am I missing here?
That's a great question. Exactly what the elevation of land is a really important question that we have here in Louisiana. And we try to do that with a high resolution GPS that that doesn't just tell you your position on Earth, but also tells you your elevation. And actually, there's a whole formal system of trying to figure out the exact elevation of every spot on Earth, not unlike, you know, finding the elevation of a mountaintop. And one of the things that scientists here in Louisiana do a lot of is try to measure the elevation. You go out with a high-resolution GPS, and you compare that to computer models, effectively computer models of the Earth. And that is actually how we know the elevation of areas in Louisiana, is by using a high-resolution GPS and comparing that to effectively computer models of the Earth. One of the nice things that came out of this project that I'm really excited about, just from a side of a scientist, is some of my co-authors, Dallin Weathers and Christy Swan, who both run small companies, they had a really inventive idea that they could take water level measurements that we took from a boat with a high-resolution GPS attached and connect that to images from a satellite and use that to come up with a map of elevations for the whole area. And I actually think that's a really nifty and neat idea.
Professor, I need a 20-second answer here. When it comes to coastal erosion and knocking down storms, does it matter if the land is above water or if it's a foot below water? Because when a storm surge comes in, it's going to be below water, right?
It's going to be below water. So if there's a big storm coming in, having any buffer helps, because the waves can break on that buffer. Of course, the higher the buffer is, the better. But if you're looking at a 20-foot storm surge or a 10-foot storm surge, it doesn't really matter whether it's a few inches or not.
I got you. Thank you, Professor. I hope you come back. Appreciate the conversation. Appreciate your time and your work. We'll take a break. Come back, talk about sugarcane and its importance to the Louisiana economy. Tommy Tucker, WWL. It is 7:14 on a Tuesday morning. It's pretty nice, but who knows what's going to happen later on today. Some flooding in Algiers yesterday and on the West Bank in Gretna, also in the Ninth Ward. And there's a chance for rain today, 50% chance for rain. And Peyton Malone, WWL Louisiana Forecast Center meteorologist, telling us he can't really tell you where or when, if that's going to happen again. So you just got to pay attention, I guess, and hope that it doesn't rain for a long time in the same spot. Because if it does, the streets are going to flood because we're underwater. But I guess we're under sea level. I guess we all know that by now. Highs of 83 today, 50% chance for showers. Pretty much same thing tomorrow. But then, just in time for Zurich Classic and Jazz Fest, clears out, sunshine, highs in the mid-80s. So get out and enjoy that. We're talking about sugarcane now with Kenneth Gravois, a sugarcane specialist with the LSU Agricultural Center. He works at the Sugar Research Station in St. Gabriel, Louisiana. How you doing, Kenneth?
Hey, good morning, Tommy. Thank you for having me.
Tell me about sugarcane, and you would think that, first of all, how big of an industry is it to Louisiana?
You know, sugarcane is our number one valued row crop in Louisiana, so it's really important to the rural communities here in the southern rural parishes. So that's what fuels those economies.
Do you have any idea how many jobs or how many people are dependent upon sugarcane in Louisiana and what kind of role it plays in Louisiana's economy percentage-wise?
Yeah, so, you know, estimates from the American Sugarcane League tell us that we employ somewhere in the neighborhood of 27,000 people in this industry.
Wow. Have things changed? Tell me about LSU's role in this, and have things changed when it comes to sugarcane? Because you would think, all right, you plant it in the ground, you grow it like you did in the 1800s or 1700s, or I guess however. How far does the history of sugarcane go back?
Well, you know, the history of sugarcane goes back to the history of Louisiana. It was first brought in to Louisiana in 1699 when Iberville came up the Mississippi River and first settled a place called New Orleans. You might be familiar with that.
But, yeah, I've heard of it.
You know, yeah, you've heard of it. So, but the role of LSU in all of this is that when you're growing a crop, any agricultural crop, there's always there's two things that we want to accomplish. One, we want to create yield, and we want to improve yield over time. Prices can become stagnant, but we can control the yield in the field. So think about the role of research. We develop new varieties of sugarcane, and to give you some perspective on the impact of that, my dad was born around 1930, and from 1930 to 1970, he's raising six kids in St. James Parish, and the yields doubled because of research at LSU, USDA, wow. Support from the American Sugarcane League. Well, he passed away at the end of 2023, and the yields doubled again. So within his lifetime, through the research efforts within the industry, he's seen yields double and double again. He grew up and raised his family as a sugarcane farmer.
How do you go about increasing yield?
So we have breeding programs. These are programs that develop new varieties of sugarcane. So we grow parents in these hybridization facilities, and we make these new varieties and elite parents flower, and then we make crossing combinations. We have male and female parents, and then once we get seed set, we germinate those seeds, and we begin a 12-year process to create new genetics, new varieties of sugarcane. So, you know, we use that to increase yield primarily. Not only yield, but the number of crops that we can grow from a single planting, because we can get multiple crops from that planting.
Do we grow as much as we can sell? And if we could grow even more, could we sell even more? And how do imports factor in all of this?
Yeah, good question. We don't produce enough sugar in the U.S., so we do have imports that come in to fill that gap. We used to have sugarcane production in Puerto Rico. It went out in the 1990s due to high costs. Hawaii went out of production in 2016 due to high costs. And Texas went out of sugarcane production in 2023 for the same reason. So the only two states growing sugarcane now are Florida and Louisiana. And the Louisiana industry has been expanding its acreage both northward and westward. And that's the result of good genetics, good varieties, and a decent price.
Yeah, I was in Hawaii a long time ago, maybe 10 years ago, and I saw a lot of sugar places that were shut down. And what made it so expensive, and why was Louisiana able to prevail?
Well, you know, places like Hawaii and Puerto Rico are islands, so to get all of your inputs into those areas is very expensive. And those are big tourist destinations, just like you took a trip to the islands. Mm-hmm. I always tell people that, you know, sugar per acre of cane cannot compete with tourists per acre.
Yeah, that makes sense. It really does. We'll take a break, pick it up. We come back talking to Kenneth Gravois, sugarcane specialist with the LSU Agricultural Center, works at the Sugar Research Station in St. Gabriel, Louisiana. Sugarcane's a $4 billion industry for Louisiana. LSU plays a big role in keeping it strong. If you all have any questions or comments, 504-260-1870. We wanted to have him on because, you know, we drive through parishes, river parishes and so forth, and we see the sugar cane growing, and then during the fall we see it harvested. And I think we take that for granted, just how much it contributes to Louisiana. Although, you probably shouldn't eat that much of it. 720 traffic now, WWL. 725, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Kenneth Gravois, sugarcane specialist with the LSU Agricultural Center, works at the Sugar Research Station in St. Gabriel, Louisiana. I'm sorry about the loss of your dad, Kenneth, but you said he was a sugarcane farmer for how long?
Oh, all his life. His father farmed, and he and his five other brothers farmed sugarcane in St. James and some of the surrounding parishes.
What was that like for you? And I'm getting some text here because people are texting, and they want to know about sugarcane. We like to educate people, and we'll ask the questions. But I just got to ask you, you know, as a kid that grew up in the suburbs and rode his bike and everything and didn't have any farm duties or anything, what's it like to grow up on a sugarcane farm? And I presume you are still a farmer or not?
No, so I work with the LSU Ag Center, so okay. I do research, but my brother's farm, and I have nephews, cousins. It's a family farming industry, and growing up in on a farm is there's no better way to grow up than be on a farm, and you know, see things grow and thrive in a local community.
So what do you have to do? You know, we see the stalks rising, and then we see it in the fall get harvested and everything. What do you have to do in between the time you plant it? Just water it, or is there a lot of maintenance involved in growing sugar cane?
Oh, it takes a lot of tending. There's a little bit of cultivation. You know, we have to build up rows. We grow cane on beds because you talked about weather and all the rain in New Orleans yesterday. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we have to get water off these fields. We have to fertilize them. You get hungry, the plants get hungry, so they get a fertilizer application. We will control the weeds, and then Mother Nature and the sugarcane plants take care of themselves. I mean, we have bred these plants to be adapted to Louisiana temperate climate. You know, this crop is tropical in origin. It really shouldn't be growing in Louisiana, but never bet against Louisiana because we'll always find a way.
Somebody texted in about exports and tariffs and all of that. Does that apply to anything with the sugarcane industry?
So we import roughly about 15% of our needs here in the United States, and those exports are controlled through trade agreements. Mexico and Canada have free access to our sugar market. We have world trade agreements with maybe 140 other countries that have a quota and access to our market. So it's a controlled market. The price does not fluctuate a lot because we control the supply coming into the country. And normally we have more than enough sugar to satisfy the needs of the consumers here in the U.S.
Somebody texted in, what do you see in the future related to precision agriculture and the harvesting of sugarcane? And I'll piggyback on that with you talked about the doubling and then the doubling again of yield. How far can this go?
You know, I was talking to a group maybe a month or two ago and mentioned about the doubling and the doubling again. And it says, well, boy, you've probably reached the top. And I'm like, no. It seemed impossible to my father probably at those times that you could double the yield of sugar. And I say, why not double it again? I mean, that's the role of science. Science is an arena where you can assume some risk in order to innovate. And so, you know, we have, you know, world-class breeders and geneticists that are constantly, you know, building and designing better adapted varieties with higher yield potential. So I don't know, the future is bright. You know, we've overcome a lot through science, and I don't see why that trend has to stop now.
None of that's cheap. Do you have the funding for the research that you want to do in terms of doubling again, or maybe even doubling that?
So, I mean, the way research is funded, you know, LSU is a public state institution. We get funded by the state legislature. We have a federal research facility, a USDA research facility in Houma, Louisiana. And the growers, you know, contribute monies to the American Sugarcane League, and they fund a lot of their research. So, you know, there's kind of a diversity in our funding, and that helps when there's ebbs and flows in those funding streams. But, you know, that three-legged stool has served us for over 140 years, and that's been our recipe for success. So we're optimistic in this industry.
Very interesting conversation. Thank you, Kenneth. Always something to learn. Kenneth Gravois, sugarcane specialist with the LSU Agricultural Center, works at the Sugar Research Station in St. Gabriel, Louisiana. And we'll talk with Fred Lopez when we come back about measles, about this 60 Minutes thing. I don't know if you saw it or not, about bird flu, H5N1. We'll talk about that and more when we return. Right now, time for WWL First News. 45, quarter till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL. If you saw 60 Minutes on Sunday night, if you saw the story about the bird flu, I would think it got your attention. maybe for a couple of different reasons. I don't know. We're going to talk about it with Dr. Fred Lopez. That and measles, Dr. Fred, our friend, infectious diseases specialist at LSU Health New Orleans School of Medicine. Let's talk about measles, Dr. Fred. How are you? Lopez. Hey, Doc, how are you?
I am okay. Yourself?
I'm okay. I'm vaccinated. I'm good to go. I'm feeling great. Let's talk about measles and cases in New Orleans. And I remember Bill Cassidy saying they were on the I-10 headed in from Texas. Tell me what the situation is with measles in the area, in the South, in the country, in the world.
Well, it's been a busy year with respect to measles. More than 800 cases reported in the U.S. so far this year, which is more than twice as many as all of last year. So a lot of cases. West Texas seems to be the hot spot, but it's spreading to other states as well. And in the last several days, we've heard about two cases of measles in the state of Louisiana, both from the New Orleans area, apparently both related to travel abroad in adults. And vaccination status of one is unclear, and the other person was not vaccinated, which is typically the case when measles is diagnosed in the United States. It's typically an under-vaccinated or unvaccinated individuals.
Are you noticing, do we track vaccination trends? RFK took a step back and said after attending the funeral in Texas that the measles vaccine was the way to go. Do you notice any changes in the trends on that, or does it take a while for something like that to happen?
Well, no, we've been tracking it, and measles vaccination rates amongst kindergartners, for example, in the state of Louisiana, several years ago were around 95-96%. And in 2023-2024, the rates had dropped to 92%. Now, that doesn't seem like a very significant drop, except for the fact that herd immunity can be achieved with 95% or greater immunization rates. So when we drop below 95%, if a measles case gets into an under-vaccinated community where these vaccination rates are lower than 95%, we can see how it might spread amongst those individuals. And that's a concern. And so tracking these trends to make sure that we try to get above 95% is really, really important. And, you know, I think there is, as we've talked about many times in the past, there's a bit of vaccination fatigue. And when we've talked about it, it's been more towards COVID-19 vaccinations, but the reality is it's spilled over a bit to some other vaccine-preventable illnesses, including measles. And we're seeing the effects of under-vaccination or unvaccination individuals being exposed to measles and getting affected with what could be threatening disease with potential for hospitalization and death.
And just for people that say, well, if you're vaccinated, why do I have to be?
Well, the reason you want to be vaccinated is you want to create a front of defense against the spread of measles. Some people who get measles may just have complications of fever, rash, maybe runny nose, and red eyes. But some people can develop severe complications, particularly infants, immunocompromised adults. These individuals, if they get infected with measles, they can develop really potentially fatal complications like brain swelling, pneumonia. And 1 to 3 individuals who are young who get infected with measles are going to die from measles. So this is something that we don't see it as frequently as we did before vaccination became available in the 1960s. Is still a big problem, and it's eliminated from the United States, but that doesn't mean we don't see it, and we're starting to see the effects again of unvaccinated or under-vaccinated individuals getting infected with measles. Again, more than 800 cases already reported this year in the United States.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up, talk about the 60 Minutes piece as it relates to bird flu. My concern is, if something like this happens, my concern is not scientific as much as it is political, if people are going to pay attention to it or not, or how likely the government is to do anything about it or not, if anything's to worry about. I don't know. We'll talk about it. But if you saw the 60 Minutes piece about bird flu, it was attention getting. 751, 9 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:56, 4 till 8, couple of minutes left with Dr. Fred Lopez, infectious diseases specialist at LSU Health New Orleans School of Medicine. 60 Minutes did about 15 minutes on bird flu. Dr. Fred, I would imagine, as an infectious disease specialist, you have to look at the worst possible case, but then you have to factor probability into that. Tell me about bird flu and where we stand on this. I don't know if you saw the 60 Minutes piece or not, but how concerned should we be?
Well, I think we should be concerned, and I think COVID-19 is an example of what can happen if we let our guard down and don't monitor the spread of a disease which has pandemic potential, which is always the case with new influenza strains. You know, right now, bird flu is considered a low public health risk as per the CDC, but that could change, and monitoring transmission of bird flu is really, really important. The real concern with bird flu is that the bird flu virus it can mutate and become more transmissible from human to human. Right now, there's no known person-to-person spread of bird flu in this country. And I just let me just repeat that, no known person-to-person spread. However, if a mutation occurred that allowed the virus to more easily transmit from human to human, that's when you would get very concerned about the risk for a pandemic. And that's what we need to monitor for. So far in this outbreak that's occurring in the United States, there have been 70 cases. And most of those cases of bird flu in this country have been mild. Maybe some conjunctivitis has been one of the more predominant manifestations of bird flu infections in this country. However, there has been one death, and that one death was in the state of Louisiana, but it was apparently in an individual that had a lot of other medical problems. So unclear if the death was directly due to the bird flu virus or due to complications from the other illnesses that this individual had. So there is the potential for severe outcomes. It is being detected. We know that it's being transmitted in poultry and cows as well. And we just need to monitor it to make sure that there's no human-to-human spread, because that's when the real concern is going to develop. Recognize as well that we do have treatments for bird flu virus infections. Same treatments that we use for human flu infections can be used to treat bird flu infections as well.
Scale of 1 to 10, how worried are you about this?
I'm worried, but I think that if we closely monitor these viruses for these mutations, I think we can stay on top of things. And because we've known about bird flu virus infections for years, we could develop a vaccine much more quickly than we did with COVID-19.
Scale of 1 to 10?
3.
Okay. Good. Thank you, Dr. Fred. I appreciate it. That's layman's terms. Dr. Fred Lopez, infectious diseases specialist at LSU Health New Orleans School of Medicine. We'll tell 8:17, Peyton Malone saying there's a 60% chance today that somebody's going to get some heavy rain like we had yesterday. And looking at the Surge and Water Board's, on the website, the dashboard, turbine 5 and 6 are online, 4 is available, 5 out of 5 EMDs are available, 89 of 93 major pumps are available, and you would presume they'd pump all the canals down and do everything they can to get ready for another rain event. And then somebody texted in and said something about they didn't like Peyton Malone's forecast because they couldn't tell him definitely what was going to happen and wish they would do like other countries and jail them when they're wrong too often. I don't know why people text in the things they do. I honestly don't. Bill joins us right now. Bill Alexander, CEO of the National Law Enforcement Memorial Officers Memorial Fund. Bill's got nearly 30 years of law enforcement experience, starting with the U.S. Air Force as a security police officer at Andrews Air Force Base. After being honorably discharged, he joined the Prince George's County Police Department in Maryland. That's a community which borders Washington, D.C. How you doing, Bill?
Tommy, I'm doing great. I so appreciate you having me back on to talk about Police Week and the heroes that we'll honor this year.
Yeah, let's talk about that. But first, I just want to talk about that text that I got about jailing meteorologists. I get some texts that make me raise my eyebrows. And just talk about, if you will, the nature of police work before we get to the ceremonies this week, just because it seems as though I think sometimes people text me because they get, you know, aggravated about this or aggravated about that, and they just need to vent. But when it comes to police work, and this is the reason I brought that up, police officers are seldom seeing people when they're at their happiest or at their best, right?
That is absolutely true. In fact, quite the opposite. Police officers usually encounter people when they are at their absolute worst, experiencing some of the worst moments in their life, maybe the worst moment in their life. You know, dealing with death, destruction, the loss of property, you know, the number of crimes just go on and on. And so police officers are interacting with people usually when they're really having a horrible day and perhaps something far worse than that. So, and on top of that, much of the police work that, you know, the men and women out on our streets working to protect us, it's oftentimes very dangerous. To some degree, it's probably dangerous for the public, but certainly it can be and has been historically very dangerous for the police officers as well. Of course, every single year, police officers die in the line of duty serving and protecting us. And that, of course, is part of what we're going to talk about here shortly in terms of Police Week and honoring those men and women who died in 2024 and years prior.
And I always like to put, you know, myself in the shoes of other people or the listening audience in the shoes of other people. And when it relates, as it relates to police officers, if I can make a comparison to maybe a waiter or a bartender or something like that, and what police officers do is night and day different than that. But here's the thing. Or maybe a salesman. Maybe you get a bad client, a bad customer, whatever, and you try not to let it ruin your day. But when it comes to police officers, every client, every customer is going to be a problem because that's why the police are there in the first place, right? So it's hard for a police officer, I would think, to deal with that every day.
You know, it really can be a struggle to sort of cleanse your mental palate from one call to the next. I remember one day where I went to the hospital for an infant who had died from sudden infant death syndrome, then went to a report call, and then went to a suicide. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you string together those kinds of calls, and it's just incredibly difficult to sort of, you know, again, cleanse that mental palate and refresh yourself and recognize that you need to bring, you know, the best part of you to whoever the next call is and interact with each person you meet with in a hopefully a positive way. It can be very, very difficult.
God bless the people that do it, man. I wouldn't. And Lord knows they're not getting rich doing it. Let me take a break, Bill. We'll talk about the ceremonies this week, okay?
Sure, that'd be great.
Bill Alexander, CEO of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. I know a lot of people tend to get on police officers and complain about this or that or the other thing, but I think you just need to put yourself in their uniform and understand everything it is that they go through, because as we said, you're dealing with people at their absolute worst, and there are few good customers. The next guy you go to or the next woman you go to is going to have the same problems or some other issue as the one before. 822 Traffic Now, WWL. 6827, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Bill Alexander, our friend, CEO of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. I appreciate the men and women that serve in law enforcement. I would never do it myself, and God bless them that do. Tell me about this week coming up and what's going to happen with the week, Bill.
Sure, yeah. So Police Week is broadly from May 11th through May 16th. Those dates are relatively stable every single year. Thousands, literally tens of thousands of law enforcement professionals, survivors, families, friends, and even just citizens from both around the country and around the world come to help celebrate the profession and also to help us memorialize the men and women who have died serving us. Of course, the notable key event for us is the Candlelight Vigil. It's hosted by the Memorial Fund. It's on the National Mall. It's always on May 13th at 8 p.m. on the Mall. And it's there where we will read aloud the names of this year, the 345 men and women who died in calendar year 2024 and the years prior, all of them having served in some law enforcement function and died in the line of duty serving us. And so we will read aloud the names of those men and women most recently added to the memorial walls, of course, very sacred to us, that National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial, the place where we, both as an organization, and I think all of us, citizens of this great country, have the opportunity to memorialize, to think about, to honor our responsibility to never forget those men and women who served and sacrificed everything for us.
When it comes to things that the average person needs to remember today, if they should interact with a police officer, what would you like them to know?
You know, I hope that your audience particularly has a positive feeling about law enforcement professionals and the men and women out on the street. I hope that they would remember that every single one of those men and women is a father or a mother, a daughter or a son, a brother or a sister, They are equally as human as everyone else out there in the world. Yes, of course, officers occasionally do make mistakes, but by and large, the men and women in uniform are doing the right things for the right reasons, in fact, very altruistic reasons. They are putting themselves in harm's way for us. So I think my one message to folks is be cognizant of the very, very tough job that those men and women in uniform are doing every single day, and recognize the very dangerous risks that they all face voluntarily. They choose, they purposely put themselves in harm's way for us. So my message would be, find your local police officer, whether they're in a coffee shop or standing on a corner directing traffic, yell out to them and say, thank you. Thank you for your service. Thank you for being willing to put your life on the line to protect me.
Thank you. I appreciate your time and your efforts, Bill, as always. Bill Alexander, CEO of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. I think we need to remember, just because somebody puts a uniform on, that doesn't make them perfect. Where would we be without law enforcement? God bless the brave men and women that do it. When we come back, speaking of law enforcement, JPSO recently fell victim to a large phishing scam. And when I saw this, the first thing that hit my mind, I'm sure as it did a lot of other people, is if it can happen to them, how easily could it happen to me? Well, we'll talk with Alex Hammerstone about that, Director of Advisory Solutions for Trusted Sec. Also about an email scam almost got me. 8:45, quarter till 9. Peyton Malone, WWR Louisiana forecast. Weather forecaster telling us there's a chance, a 60% chance that we might see rain like we did yesterday afternoon. It's hard to tell where it's going to fall because they are predicting the future here, right? So just be flooded street aware. I don't think the city has changed neutral ground parking or allowed it. I haven't gotten a NOLA ready text yet. So if anything changes there, we'll certainly let you know. And we saw this story about the JPSO, an auditor revealing that JPSO had stolen email scammers up $1.1 million from the Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office. And immediately my thought was, well, if it can happen to them, what chance do we have? And I got some other suspicious texts and emails, so it's always a good idea to check in with our friend Alex Hammerstone, Director of Advisory Solutions for Trusted Sec, to see what the latest is. How you doing, Alex?
Not too bad. It's 62 degrees here in Cleveland today, so it's a heat wave for us.
Well, I'll take it. We love it here because it's starting to get hot and humid in summertime and afternoon showers and all that stuff. And late April and May is not good for us when it comes to rain and street flooding. Let's talk about what happened here with the Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office and what this scam looked like.
So these scams are incredibly common. And I think what's interesting is, you know, it's only really a news story because it was the sheriff's department. And so we see these things all day, every day, both with businesses and, you know, people in their personal lives being scammed out of large sums of money. I mean, sometimes it's a couple thousand dollars, sometimes it's hundreds of thousands of dollars, and as you see in the story, millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And what's pretty common is that scammers will ask you for money, right? And the easiest way to do that is to get you to wire the money or send money, you know, to a fake account. So what they'll do is you'll get an email that looks like what you're expecting, right? It's a pretty common invoice or, you know, kind of your accounts payable. And they'll just change the account number. So everything will look good. Everything will look like it should, except they've changed the account numbers. And there's a couple of different ways they can do this, right? Some are just, you know, phishing emails, you know, that they'll just send it to everybody and ask you for a payment. But we also sometimes will see that a scammer will break into someone's email and then send the request from the real email address. And that's incredibly tough to detect. I mean, imagine if you and I were, you know, had a business relationship and paid each other every week, and someone broke into my email and then just changed the account numbers and sent you the email you've been getting every week, but with a new account number, you're going to fall for it.
I saw an email from AT&T, allegedly, purportedly from AT&T, and I even sent Jordan, our producer, a screenshot of it because I almost fell for it. It's amazing how what you get on the email can look exactly like the AT&T site, but then when you got to look at the address where it came from, right? That's where the proof is in the pudding?
So that's a tough one, right? Because I took a look at that email, and the only thing that really jumped out as being a bit unusual was the address it came from. Mm-hmm. But the challenge is companies use third parties or kind of unique email addresses and domains legitimately all the time. So it's really tough to tell. And when you look at kind of the emails that we get every day from companies, it's very easy just to copy and paste all that text and create the exact same email. You know, we're used to these phishing emails with misspellings and all those other things. But these days, that's not always a good indicator. You know, oftentimes these phishing emails look perfect.
So I didn't know Jordan had shared a picture of that with you that I got.
Yes, he did share it. That's the only way I saw it. Don't worry, I wasn't in your email.
No. I don't care about that. I'm just wondering, so that was not a legitimate email, was it?
It didn't look like it, you know, kind of based on the return address. You know, and again, that's the challenge is these emails can be absolutely identical to legitimate emails. You know, if you look at, you know, how easy it is to copy the content of a website, I mean, it really is copy-paste the code. Mm-hmm. And so you can create kind of mirrored websites or, you know, exact copies of emails that are going to trick a lot of people. You know, it'd be very easy. You know, I live and breathe this stuff every day.
Right.
And that email that you received is something that I could easily fall for. Right?
I almost
if I'm just
did.
Not paying attention.
Yep, I almost
blame
did.
You.
And then I checked the address. So when we're talking about phishing, but if I wanted to go phishing, phishing with this website to see what they were up to, let's talk about that when we come back and some things you should do and not do. Also, the latest scams that are going around with the text messages. 504-260-1870. If you have any questions about the latest internet scam, Alex Hammerstone, our guest, Director of Advisory Solutions for Trusted Sec. He's our go-to guy. And we'll pick it up here. We'll come back on WWL. Right now, look at traffic. 8:55 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Alex Hammerstone, our friend, Director of Advisory Solutions for Trusted Sec. About the latest internet scams that are going around, and somebody else texted me about an AT&T email that they got, and I don't want to disclose, obviously, my private information here, but Jordan did share a screenshot of it with you, Alex, and you said it would have caught you. It almost caught me. What's the best thing to do in a situation like this? Because it looks exactly like it's from AT&T. And again, the only thing that tipped me off is when I went to the address to reply, and it had talked about information being compromised, etc. Now, I mentioned before the break, if I were to go phishing, just on a little exploratory mission probing to see what they were looking for, can I get into trouble doing that or not, or is it best just to leave it alone?
It's best really to leave it alone. Mm-hmm. You know, what they're looking for is for you to click, and it'll open up a web page that'll look like what you expect, right? It'll be a copy of the legitimate site, and it will ask you for your username and password. Mm-hmm. And so once they have that, they have access to your account. And so it's really best to leave these things alone. But what's interesting is, you know, we all get these emails from companies all the time, right? We get them from places we shop or utilities or what have you. And it's convenient, right, to click in a link from your utility company or your phone company. But really the best advice is if you get an email from your cell phone provider or your electric company or what have you, is to, you know, then go directly to the website, right? Don't click on a link in the email. But go to AT&T.com or the site that you know is legitimate and go from there. But clicking in the links to the emails, you know, can get you in trouble.
I got a text here from a listener that says they've gotten a text that says you've been randomly selected for an important scientific study focusing on Louisiana voters. Could be a legitimate pollster, could not be. How do you deal with those, Alex?
So that's a tough one, too. You know, I get a ton of the polls, you know, people asking me, you know, what I think of certain things. I hate to say it, but it's usually best to just to ignore them because it's pretty common that they may be a scam. They may be looking to, you know, harvest personal information. And it may be somebody doing that, again, to scam you or maybe just to put you on a mailing list. So, you know, certainly there are legitimate polls out there. You know, the pollsters are going to reach out to people in ways that they're used to, right? I mean, people don't have home phones anymore, so the polling's moved to other ways. But random text, I mean, a text that you weren't expecting, you can generally just ignore that.
So when it comes to Social Security, somebody texted in, they don't know what to do because I have a neighbor of mine that's on Social Security. He'll come over and show me things occasionally that say it is official from Social Security that they'll never call you or whatever. Can you trust the snail mail when it comes in, or do they fish snail mail to make it seem as though, okay, trust this and not the internet, when in fact what you're getting out of your mailbox is fraudulent?
So, you know, especially with Social Security, there are really two types of snail mail you might get that are illegitimate or not what you want. The first is, you know, somebody that's, you know, 100% a scammer and trying to steal your data. And they very well may, you know, mail you these days. The other one, though, is things that, you know, they're not necessarily illegal, but they're illegitimate, right? It's somebody that's trying to sell you something and, you know, purporting to be endorsed by the Social Security Administration or what have you. So those are tough as well. It just really feels like the scammers are coming at us, you know, from every medium and, you know, everything they're throwing everything they can at us. And they're coming at us with texts and mail and email and telephone calls and everything else.
That's why I got my money in a coffee can hidden in the backyard. Thank you, Alex. I appreciate it.
Have a great day.
You have a good day. All right, Alex Hammerstone, Director of Advisory Solutions for TrustedSec. Now that I've said that, I got to go dig a new hole. We'll be back talking about food recalls and more on WWL. Into the 9 o'clock hour we go, fully loaded, but I got to tell you, first of all, the password to register to win a pair of tickets to the second weekend of Jazz Fest, and it is Gumbo. That's simple. Don't miss your chance to win. All you have to do is listen at 9, noon, 3, and 6 for the Jazz Fest code word of the day to see amazing artists like Pearl Jam, Luke Combs, Lenny Kravitz, KG Elephant, Santana, Patti LaBelle, Trombone, Shorty, and more. So I've given you that code word, Gumbo. You go to WWL.com/contest and register to win, and bada boom, bada bing, you're done. It's that simple. So we'll have a word for you every day at 9, noon, 3, and 6 for the second weekend of Jazz Fest. And I've already congratulated our previous winners, Bruce Wyatt of Kenner, Jason McGinn of Metairie, Harry Cabraceras of Covington, Kristen Jones of Marrero, and Chris Miller, not our Chris Miller, of Metairie. You could be the next one. Just go to WWL.com/contests and enter today's password, which happens to be Gumbo. All right, we're joined now by Darren Detweiler, Associate Teaching Professor at Northeastern University, to talk about food safety and food recalls in the country. How you doing, Professor?
Great. Yourself?
Real good, sir. We've had you on before. It's a pleasure to talk to you as always, and I would like to open the Oakland on Jeweler talk and text line here. Text and message rates, I don't know, might apply, whatever you need to know. And don't text and drive, 504-260-1870. If you have any words about different types of food, any questions are out there about different types of food or food poisoning or recalls, et cetera. Professor, one thing I wanted to start with DOGE and the FDA cuts, how important is it, and I guess we'll start with context, how important is it that the inspection process in the United States, and how does it compare with other countries in keeping what we eat and drink safe?
Well, first off, there's multiple levels of challenges. And while I'm always supportive of the idea of efficiency and improvement, I'm concerned about the idea of making certain changes, cuts to funding, cuts in terms of staffing and eliminating certain roles and losing experts in this when we're still driving down the freeway at full speed, if you will, in terms of food safety. It's not like we're taking a pause in terms of the foods we eat and the foods we bring into our border and the foods across state lines. So it's a very complex system in the United States, perhaps more complex than in most other developed nations, in that we say things like America has the safest food supply in the world, but the reality is we have probably the most complex in terms of the fact that it's not just like one nation. It's not even 50 states. Many states are divided into different jurisdictions. We have essentially, when you start looking at military bases, you start looking at tribal reservations and protectorates, we have about 3,000 different jurisdictions when it comes to food, if you look at food safety and regulatory authority. So controlling all this is very important. Obviously, efficiency and effectiveness is important. It's been talked about for a long time. We have significant gaps and a lack of uniformity across these jurisdictions, and even at the federal level. There's 15 different federal agencies that play a role in this. So in terms of your question specifically, I think there's change that needs to be made. My biggest hope is that it is true change and that the process of making this change does not put consumers in more danger in the meantime.
How do you, you know, as you say that, what pops into my mind is how do you draw the distinction between redundancy and waste? Because sometimes there is a need for redundancy, right?
We definitely have a need for redundancy. There is so we talk about things in terms of the farm to table, but we don't look at, for instance, farm to hospital or even beyond the hospital in terms of things. You've heard news like. Remember last year we heard the news about the Boar's Head outbreak and mm-hmm. how 10 people were killed? And McDonald's, remember how McDonald's had the onions mm-hmm. that were contaminated in certain places? Well, the same time they announce these things, they'll say things like, well, the people that got sick, their illnesses reported, 6 or 8 weeks ago kind of a thing. We don't hear about recalls or outbreaks until after there is significant public health impact. Essentially, we don't call outbreaks until and recalls or one or the other until people are already harmed. So it's not like we do testing to prevent this stuff to get out before it gets to the stores or to the restaurants. We do, but there's always a delay. But typically, again, you almost never hear about a recall or outbreak until after someone's already been hurt, harmed, hospitalized, or even killed.
As you say that, I'm thinking, and this is going to be a big, long question. I hope it doesn't catch you in an area that you're not familiar with. But we always hear about, we talk about Chinese cranes when it relates to the Trojan horses and what happens at the ports. When it comes to the food safety in the country, that really is a element of national security, is it not?
Oh, definitely. We don't have to go too far. Last year, if you recall, there was an issue with heavy metals in applesauce, and it turned out that it was imported cinnamon that was heavily contaminated with lead. And this is like a food fraud issue in which lead, or essentially like lead rust, was used to supplement cinnamon and make it look like there was more without actually having the cinnamon. So when there's opportunity for economic gain, we see this from other countries. We see this even from within the United States. But when we see problems like this where there is fraud or crime or just the opportunity where there are food items or ingredients that are not at the same level of safety that come to our borders at various ports, obviously international ports, it becomes problematic because when we want to have, more convenient, ready-to-eat foods, commercially packaged goods, and we're not buying, a raw produce or raw meat kind of a thing. We're buying something that's frozen, that's already made kind of a deal. We are making a significant assumption that not only has the company behind the label done their due diligence, but wherever they get their ingredients from, of course, they're going to buy from buy low, right? The cheapest person they can buy from, that's typically more and more from outside of the United States. This becomes more problematic for us in terms of the level of, and the challenge, if you will, in terms of the difficulty of making sure our food is safe.
So you're going to augment cinnamon, and you don't pick an inert ingredient. You pick rusty metal because it looks like cinnamon. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
This kind of thing happens a great deal at the time where there's foods that are supplemented with different things. You can go back into America's history and look at when chalk has been added to milk or when other things have been added to food or when food, it says it's from here, but it's actually from a different location, or it says that it's this kind of fish. We see this a lot. It says that it's this kind of fish, but it's actually some other cheaper kind of a fish that's more readily available. So there is not just food safety issues, but there's food security and authenticity issues at play as well. Again, leading to the level of difficulty in terms of how do we regulate food within the United States.
So when you talk about that cinnamon incident and others like it, how would the United States even go about checking what was coming into the country from other countries? Because you can't check every bottle that comes in. I guess you can either rely on the country from which it is imported, or does the United States have inspectors that go over there and look at the plants?
This is one of those things where if it was a multiple choice question, the answer would be D, all of the above.
Okay.
I know some companies that not only are you looking at the fact that the FDA has gone over to that country and has evaluated their food safety standards and kind of rated them and have helped them rated, as in given them a rating in terms of how well they align with U.S. standards. They'll go over, there are agencies and universities that will go over to other countries and help. I've done some of this work where we go over and help other countries with their food standards and their food training. But then you have companies that literally they will send people over there to do independent testing of the farms, of the factories, of the processing in other countries before it's even shipped over to the United States. And then at the U.S. border, there'll be inspections to make sure that the paperwork and the auditing and inspection is done there. And then when it gets from the border to the actual company, like, you know, again, to take that, let's use the example of the cinnamon, to use the cinnamon and now make the applesauce with the cinnamon in it, they'll do yet another round of testing. So, you know, whether you call it redundant or just multi-levels of scaffolded testing and auditing and inspection, that is what the American consumer assumes takes place when these things go on. When we hear about the cost of food rising, we think it's because of these multiple interventions and inspections and audits and testings at different points to make sure that at every level there is that transparency. We hear the word transparency a lot these days. There is that transparency all along food's journey to make sure that it truly is as safe and as described on its label.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back and we'll talk about, you know, Professor, as you're talking about this, I'm thinking of a prison guard that goes home at night and he catches eight guys going over the wall and he's feeling pretty good about himself. But then right as he falls asleep, he gets to thinking, wait a minute, what about the others I didn't catch? What about the 15 I didn't catch? We'll talk about the stuff that gets through that doesn't get detected. Darren Detweiler, our guest, associate teaching professor at Northeastern University. He's an author, professor at Northeastern, about food safety, what the government does, how the whole system works, about food recalls, food poisoning, food safety, food security. Any questions, comments, 504-260-1870. And I would also like to ask when we come back how subject is our food supply to foreign manipulation. 920, Tommy Tucker, back in a flash, WWL. Interesting conversation, as always, with Darren Detweiler, associate teaching professor at Northeastern University. Professor, in a nutshell, tell people what it is you do.
So as a professor, I focus on not only regulatory compliance, but I teach courses like global economics of food and agriculture and corporate social responsibility. But this parallels the work that I do as an author and an advisor. I advise many companies and governments. I sit on various advisory boards. I currently sit on an FDA advisory board and a CDC work group, but I've worked with the National Environmental Health Association. In the past, I've served in various capacities as an advisor for the Food and Drug Administration and the USDA, excuse me, as well, the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And basically for three decades, I've been working in this kind of capacity where I represent the consumer perspective. I do this whether it's on, you know, boards or advisory committees or sometimes on stage and in print and even in documentaries like the Netflix documentary Poisoned, The Dirty Truth About Your Food, that just won an Emmy, which in itself is awesome that a documentary about food safety and the issues that we're dealing with in terms of the complexity of our food system was made and won an Emmy.
Tell me about that Emmy-winning film on Netflix, which I'll do my best to watch. But what is it that you uncovered? What are some of the takeaways from that?
Well, first, it looked at this idea that when we say America has the safest food supply in the world, what does this really mean, and why is it that most leading experts kind of laugh at that statement? Because it's not used as a statement that says we have to uphold this standard. It's kind of used by policymakers and too many executives and policymakers as an excuse for us not to do more. Like, we don't have to have better regulation, better policies, because we already have the safest. But do we have the safest? Because essentially, one of the things I talked about is that for almost three decades now, we've held on to the fact that some 48 million Americans get sick, 128,000 are hospitalized, and some 3,000 people die due to failures in food safety in America every single year. That's equivalent to having a 9/11 worth of lost lives every year due to failures in our food supply. And the thing is that this number has not changed. It has not improved by even 1%. So whereas the optimist in me says, well, you know what, it's become more and more complex, our food supply, our food system has become more and more complex, perhaps
the work that's gone in terms of science and technology and policy and the Herculean efforts of so many people within the food industry and within food regulatory agencies have kept it at bay, it still begs the question, why have we not improved these numbers even 1% in the last three decades?
I watched the documentary Fed Up, and it changed my life in terms of sugar and the way I eat. And I'm concerned with watching this, Professor, because I'm afraid I'm not going to eat anything else ever again.
Well, you know, at the end, I am asked I'm in like 35% of the movie. I was a technical consultant, and it's part of the content is based on my first book. And I talk about what happened 30 years ago that was considered to be the landmark event that kicked off our current era of food safety. But at the very end, I'm asked, what are the foods that I personally avoid? And I list those. And there's people who's like, that's crazy. Why do you avoid those foods? But then they're like, wait a minute. When the movie came out in 2023, that fall, all three of those foods that I listed were in the middle of huge outbreaks and recalls.
So what are they?
I don't eat cantaloupe, and people are always scratching their head about it.
You're talking about cut prepackaged at the grocery store or just in general?
I don't eat any cantaloupe at all.
Okay.
Cantaloupe is, you cannot adequately clean the outside, and it has a pH balance inside that is, the pH inside it really supports the rapid growth of pathogens. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the idea of how many deaths, and this is, most people aren't even aware of this. There was an outbreak tied to cantaloupe a while back. 33 people were killed. There was another more recent outbreak where, again, more people were killed because of cantaloupe and how contaminated it was on the inside when you bring that knife through it. The largest number of people, I think, in the U.S., from any one contaminated food was because of cantaloupe. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, if you save leftovers in your refrigerator, it increases the odds for the pathogens to grow. And I would recommend if you really want to eat cantaloupe, don't save any leftovers, kind of a thing. I also just personally, my decision is I don't eat cantaloupe. The second thing is bagged lettuce. You know, we see these kind of convenient options where you have different mixes of leafy greens. The amount of recalls and outbreaks we've had over the last decade from leafy greens has been just ridiculous. You know, you can buy a head of lettuce and you get one item from one place. But when you're buying some of these bags of mixed lettuce, you're getting multiple heads and sometimes from multiple places even. And if it's not cleaned properly, because we don't cook salads, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have what's called a kill step. And the number of people that get sick from bagged lettuce every year is incredible. And the third item is traditional sprouts. I don't know if people are paying attention to this, but most major retailers stop selling sprouts because of how many times it's being recalled year after year after year. Even Jimmy John's, famous for their sandwiches, one of their major popular ingredients has been sprouts, and they kept having to take it off because they kept having people getting sick from their sprouts because they were contaminated. And then they would put it back on the menu because people demanded it, and then they would take it off the menu because people got sick. And year after year was this continuous battle with sprouts. Now, I've learned that there's a new way of making sprouts. I actually went to a sprout company in the San Francisco area and saw how traditional sprouts were made and why they're always contaminated, because basically they're just continuously watered at 70 degrees Fahrenheit, mm-hmm. and it allows for the pathogens to grow and to spread. Whereas there's a new modern way of growing sprouts that the entire operation takes place below 41 degrees, that making it impossible for pathogens to grow. And these are actually allowed back into stores now. You can buy them, kind of a thing. It sounds like I'm giving a commercial here. The point being is that there are ways in which science and technology and policy are making an impact. We can see it here with the sprouts. They figured out a different way to make the sprouts. Or the decisions you can make, again, like making decisions to consume or how to consume bagged lettuce or cantaloupe. So a lot of it is information or personal decision, in addition to the policies and the science and technology that is being used to make our food even safer.
How dependent is the United States on foreign countries for our food supply and the safety of food that we eat?
That's a great question. It's a growing amount. You know that like over 50% of our fresh fruit comes from, you know, through U.S. imports from other countries. Mm-hmm. And 90% of our seafood, right? So, you know, when food is grown or processed or packaged overseas, the U.S. has less direct control over how it's handled. Think about it. We have thousands of ports of entry and millions of shipments of food, yet the FDA inspects less than 2% of imported food shipments. And we've now been pushing for the last 14 years for stronger preventive controls and supply, foreign supplier verification that can verify the suppliers, and there's auditing of these farms, and it can help us respond more quickly to this. Because again, it's just not possible to inspect everything. So we rely on this trust. We rely on the paperwork. We rely on the spot checks, kind of like that redundancy you were talking about earlier, to catch when our system is more vulnerable to these intentional fraud or even unintentional lapses in food safety. Because the reality is, you know, you go to a restaurant, you go to a grocery store, and you're thinking like, oh, this is an American brand, American company kind of deal, right? But we have ingredients from India. There's processing of food in China. There's packaging of food in Mexico. And, you know, it matters more and more in terms of the idea that the more hands through which food passes, there's more chances for contamination, for mishandling, and even for false documentation. So you start looking at these issues, and what are we dealing with right now? We have countries with weaker economies, excuse me, that we have examples of where there are corners being cut to meet demand or reduce costs. When we have trade negotiations, which we've been talking about for the last couple months here, a more volatile trade situation between countries, these sometimes deprioritize safety in favor of volume and speed. And of course, we have mislabeling and other things that ultimately, you know, this economic pressure in other countries literally incentivizes cheaper and riskier practices. And without any kind of stronger global enforcement or consequences, you know, unsafe practices thrive, but ultimately the most vulnerable, those who are very young, like under 5 years of age, our elderly, those who are pregnant, those who are immunocompromised, those are the ones who suffer the most consequences.
We're going to take a break. Actually, you know, we have Steve Nelson coming up. Professor, thank you for your time. The name of the Emmy Award-winning documentary on Netflix is Poison, The Dirty Truth About Your Food. I guess watcher beware, but it gives you some information you need to know. I appreciate your time and your efforts, Professor. I really do. Darren Detweiler, Associate Teaching Professor at Northeastern University. We'll talk to you again soon. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, they got another threat for some weather today that could affect us. We'll talk with Steve Nelson, who is the General Superintendent of the Sewerage and Water Board, when we return. Right now, traffic, WWL. Hi, 9:45, quarter till 10, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Another rainy afternoon forecast. Steve Nelson joins us now, our friend, General Superintendent of the Sewerage and Water Board. How you doing, Steve?
I'm doing well, Tommy. Thank you.
Tell me what's going on over there. Is Ghassan still in charge, or are you running the place?
Ghassan's in charge until May 2nd will be his last day with the board.
And then what happens? Do we know?
Yeah, the board's in the process of a national search for a replacement. I expect they'll be making a decision shortly.
Did you put your name in that hat or not?
The board is working hard to vet through. They had over 70, actually just about 70 applicants, so a lot of folks interested in the job, and I think that's a testament to the job that Ghassan has done in getting the board ready and in a position to succeed going forward.
And were you one of them or not?
I did put my hat in the ring,
okay.
And I know there were a lot of really qualified candidates, so it's an honor to serve in any capacity.
I was just curious. I was just wondering. Tell me about the dashboard and pumping and power that people can look at, because, you know, first of all, let me take a step back. Steve, what happened yesterday in Algiers and Ninth Ward? Where did Orleans Parish have problems?
Yeah, so the primary issues that I've heard about, I've seen reports of water on the street in the French Quarter, the CBD, and we did take 6 to 7 inches of water in those areas over the course of a couple of hours. The bulk of the rain, though, fell on Algiers Point and then the lower Ninth Ward. And I've seen some reports of almost 10 inches of rain over the course of 4 to 6 hours, which is a storm that happens statistically between 1 in 50 and 1 in 100 years. So really uncommon levels of rain in a very short period of time. And when your system is set up to take an inch an hour, if you're taking 2, 3, 4 inches in an hour and doing that over multiple hours, it's going to overwhelm your capacity.
It seems like when you talk about those numbers with the statistical probability, boy, it just seems like we're getting a lot more rain a lot more frequently. Is that accurate or is it just perception?
Yeah, statistically, what I have seen is that on average, we get about the same amount of rain in a given year, which is between 60 and 65 inches, which is a lot. What we have seen in the last decade or so is that that rain is falling in shorter increments. So instead of getting it spread out over the course of 8, 10, 12 hours, we're getting it in the space of 2, 3, and 4.
So I saw somebody interviewed yesterday, and look, God bless them. I know it's frustrating when the streets flood or when somebody's car floods or, God forbid, it gets into their homes, and they say, you know, this is enough. They got to do something. Something's got to be done, and I empathize with that person. I really do. But when you get 10 inches of rain in a short period of time, there is nothing you can do ever in this area, is there?
Well, anything's doable with a long enough lever. The question just becomes, is there enough funding and enough time to be able to make it happen? And the first thing that I look at when we get reports of flooding is I look at the street level, and then I look at the elevation of the canal at our pump station, and that will tell me if the issue is with our pumps, with our canals, or with our catch basins and small lines. And what we saw yesterday in Algiers and the lower Ninth Ward and every place I did some drive arounds is that the level of rain that we got did not overwhelm our pumps, but it was certainly more than the catch basins, the laterals, and in Algiers' case, you know, the canals could handle. And so, you know, at this point, the system is not designed to handle that level of rain. But in order to be able to do that, yes, it does require a lot of investment, in particular on the federal level. To offer a little bit of hope, the Algiers area, the SELA program, which the Army Corps has been helping fund that program since the 90s, does have a project on that General de Gaulle, the canal down de Gaulle, that I think will help alleviate some of these things in the future. But to your point, a 1 in 100-year storm is not something we're set up for right now.
Yeah, I should have said anything. A contractor will tell you anything can be done if you have the money. I can do anything you want. I'll put a swimming pool on your ceiling if you want. Sure, if you got the money, we can do it. When it comes to preparation for a day like today, which is, it might be a day like yesterday. What do you do in advance of that, Steve, to make sure that everything's ready and pumping as much as they possibly can?
Yeah, absolutely. The things that we do in advance is make sure that we've got the proper amount of staffing. We make sure that we've got the proper turbines up and running, which turbine 5 is up and running right now. We've got staff at the stations, and we're pumping down the canals to make sure they're as empty as possible so that we can take as much rain as we can in a given shot.
So when I'm looking at this dashboard, and it tells me, help us to navigate this dashboard if you can, although it's radio and there aren't pictures. It tells me about the pumps that are working. It tells me about the turbines that are online. Tell me how to read this thing. Turbine 5 and 6 are online. 4 is available.
Yes, and 5 and 6 are the turbines that we're going to rely on for a situation like today, and the EMDs as well. Turbine 4 is a really old piece of equipment. It takes about 3 hours to get heated up. So unless I know it, and once it's hot, I have to have a load for it. So it's a piece of equipment that I really can only use if I know exactly when and where it's going to rain, which we don't have that. We don't have that granularity today. So we're going to rely on turbines 5 and 6 and the EMDs and then our frequency changers today. And that should be ample power to power those pumps that we need to power.
EMDs are?
Yeah, the EMDs, I'm sorry, they're converted diesel locomotive engines. Mm-hmm. So they produce the flavor of power that we need. And we've talked about this power complex project. That's going to start coming online here end of June, first week of July. We'll have brand new equipment that will start replacing these old turbines and EMDs. Now, it's not going to be a panacea. If you get 10 inches of rain and that canal level's below the street level, you got to start with the catch basins, the laterals, and the canals. Going through that dashboard, you can see the amount of power available. When it's in green, we know we've got ample power, the number of major pumps available. The vast majority of our major drainage pumps are up and running. We do have one pump that's on standby emergency service for Algiers. We have one pump we have three pumps that are out in New Orleans East, but those have redundancy built into the systems so that we should be able to handle that 1 inch an hour. Again, if it falls more than an inch in an hour, we're going to start to see water pond in the street, and then the mission moves towards getting it off the street. The next kind of page down that you can see as you scroll down that page is a real-time depiction of which pump stations have pumps running. Mm-hmm. So when the dots on that map are green, it says that we've got pumps ready to run. And when they switch to blue, you can see that they're running. So looking at it right now, I can see that we've got pumps, especially in New Orleans East, where we're pulling those canals down. I know because I've got real-time data on where the canals are that we've got the canals low in the older part of the city and on the West Bank.
I don't see any out of service, do I?
When you look not on that dashboard, when you click on the equipment status, there's a blue bar there. You can see which pumps are out where. And as I mentioned, we've got one serving Algiers that's available for emergency use. And then we have one at Station 14, which is out in New Orleans East, that is out of service. But then that station is connected by the Morrison Canal to two others, and within that station we got four pumps that provide redundant capacity.
So real quick, where would you least like to see it rain today, Steve?
Well, New Orleans East is actually our most storm-ready area. That Morrison Canal, when it was initially designed, has a lot of redundancy built into it. Where we typically have problems is, and folks will generally know this, is the Lakeview area, parts of Mid-City, Gentilly. If it drops, five, six, 7 inches over the course of 1, 2, or 3 hours, that's when things start to stack up.
When it comes to the water's got to get into the system for it to be pumped out, right? So when it comes to oak leaves and all of the stuff that's clogging up the drains and clearing of drains, I know that's public works, but how concerned are you with just the oak leaves and things that just happen? I mean, it just happens.
Well, the system is all of its parts together, so it's easy to focus on a pump or a power component, but it starts at the street level, and it starts with things that I can do at my house. If I blow my grass clippings into the yard and not into the street, if I pick up trash off the side of the street, if I pick up the leaves, that's debris that can end up in the catch basins, and that's all stuff that we as individuals can do. And then once it gets into the catch basin, we got to be able to clear it out. And so as of January, the Sewage and Water Board has taken over that small diameter system. And so what we're working towards is that goal of being able to clean 20% of the system every year, which means you'll clean all of it once in every five. Now, that doesn't mean you'll hit everything every 5 years. Some areas where you've got heavier tree canopy, we're going to want to hit that every single year. But that does require funding, which the state and the city have been helpful in getting us launched on that. So this year we're standing that up. And then from there, it's got to get into the canals. And then from there, it's got to get to the pump stations. And this is where with the larger projects, so it starts with the catch basins, us cleaning catch basins and laterals, then to the canals. And we've got to maintain those. But there's also a program that the Army Corps has funded, the CELA program, since the 90s, which actually has a project going on the West Bank in Algiers right now to increase the size of that canal.
Got to run, Steve.
The water, yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate the information. I really do. I hope you come back. Quick break. Back in a flash, WWL.